Okay, this is continuing with Harry Minute on 2nd March, 78.
Yes, the antennas we were using had gone up gradually. This was the 1.25 cm, full feet in diameter. This was the 10 cm one. That's a polarizing screen I made to get the cross polarizations. And then we used to run out to Cotts Hill.
These are all left over from the war?
Yeah, World War stuff. This is a photograph of the... Potts Hill is a centre for Sydney's water distribution and a quiet place. And the authorities there negotiated with us to allow us to use it. And we had this antenna that I mentioned, the rectangular
aperture,
that Frank Kerr had a bit to do with it. And we used that at 25 centimetres, and then...
What did Kerr use it for?
Oh, he was using it for some longer wavelength cosmic work, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. It's mentioned, it'll be mentioned in the... 25 centimeter paper. I guess it's this one.
1951.
Yeah. Yes. Antenna.
Oh, that's right.
It doesn't matter, but that was the antenna, and this switch that I developed. We'd previously, you see, it's 1, 3, and 10 centimeters, simply switched between the sky and an ambient temperature rotating wheel of absorbing material. For the first time, I felt I was able to do a straight switch between two transmission lines, and this thing resulted. So we could have one antenna on this side, and we could put a warm load on this side if we wanted to, but we had the ability to put it on another antenna. And I think the second one... this one was used. It's coupled to the other side of this thing, and this one went on one side and this thing on the other. So we're able to switch between two antennas at about the same temperature. So maybe hundreds of degrees differential, which made for more stability and was instrumental in getting very good stability and then being able to get the Crab Nebula.
Let's see now, you're talking about the 25 and 10 centimeter work on the galactic plane. Is that in that paper also?
That is, they're both in there, but the reference here was to the 25 centimeter work, that antenna. And what I was saying was that these antennas were gradually getting bigger, we're finding the need for more collecting area. And we, this was only borrowed, from Frank Kerr for a limited period. We felt the need for as big a one as we could make, and as precise as we could make. And we started the design on the drawing office, and Joe closed it down. It was using effort up. I don't think no one else was wanting to do that, but using effort up that he
thought. How big were you thinking? 85 foot sort of thing?
No, we wouldn't have been able to cope with something that big. No, it would have been one that we owned ourselves and would have been in the 20-odd feet margin. And,
well, that's true. You wanted it to be good to a very short wavelength.
This was mesh. We would have liked that one that went. You know, those negative results that we were talking about with more collecting area, we might have done better. And I'm sure that was in Jack's mind, that if we had enough collecting area and a good surface, we might be able to do something. He was pretty upset about that, and a couple of years ago, he said to me that he still thought it was the right decision at the time, and if we'd gone ahead, we would have made a real contribution.
Pittington said this.
Yeah. It was a straight disagreement, though.
What was Posse's reasoning?
I think it was the resources that we were consuming. It was a fair bit, you know, out of the engineering resources of the place, and quite an effort was going into it. There was Mills coming along with his ideas, and crisscross. And the place was pretty heavily loaded. And that would have been a major mechanical engineering exercise. So
anyway, you were starting to think about big dishes even at this early stage.
Yes, that was a few years before. You see, Joe never took to the Parkes one straight away. Parkes, that was Taffy. He was getting very excited about the interferometric techniques. Very exciting developments there. Scientifically challenging, nice and subtle. That was where his heart would lie.
Mm-hmm.
Taffy was a man who'd go directly to a... I'd say it was an obvious solution. The right path, in retrospect, would have been to be able to do both, you see. We didn't have the money. They were both right.
Yeah,
but it had to
yeah.
be one, and Taffy was quite clear that... He wasn't clear where he was going to get to with the interferometry techniques. They seemed marvelous brainwaves, but, you know, they might come to a dead end. The other way, he could see... He was pretty far-sighted. He could see the need for very big dishes. He could see that if he tried hard enough, he'd get one. And that he felt this was the way to go. And Taffy felt... strongly enough about something, he'd overcome any opposition. So Pawsey didn't, he wasn't tremendously enthusiastic. He could see the need for that power, that he's had was the alibi, mm-hmm. interactive and not resulted event.
What sort of interferometer do you think he was thinking of? Something like the Cambridge 2C?
Well, that was all these ideas, like crisscross, the grating, cross grating, the mills. These things were on the go in those early days. And I suppose he had an intuitive sense there were a lot of others around the corner. You know, that's the Fourier transform work, if he persisted with that the way Ryle did, he might have got the synthesis telescope. But he could see the whole field of exciting potential things, and he wasn't too excited about the structural mechanical problems of Big Dish, whatever he was.
Well, now, Dick McGee has told me about that he worked for a while on the idea of a Big Arecibo type thing, which Poisson was very interested in, and which eventually was discarded as not being
600-footer.
Practical.
Yeah.
So there was a case where Poisson wanted to go for the Big Dish.
But once again, you see, it was a matter of using nature to help you. It wasn't a straight engineering job, it was to find a hole in the ground.
It was a clever way to do something.
A clever way of doing things. Yeah. He was a string and sealing wax man. He'd been brought up in the Cavendish laboratory. I remember him telling me you went around the Woolworths to make your resistors. You bought your graphite and a few other things. It made him make everything, you see. Didn't help him at all.
No, I was thinking that in my mind. You're not the first person to say that about Poisson, but certainly he's much more in the tradition of Ryle, who came out of Cavendish too, of course. Whereas it seems like Bowen is more in the tradition of Lovell. Build the big thing. And
also at heart, he's a big project. Was a big project man. He wasn't daunted by big things, and they were clear to him where you would go.
Yeah.
Just a lot of human problems and many problems to overcome. Whereas the other had these scientific difficulties, and that wasn't his scene at all.
But did not Poisson eventually become enthusiastic about the big
Yes, he put his shoulder to the wheel, all right. Don't think he would have gone there for himself.
Right, but when did that change of heart take place?
Once it became a going project. You can see what happened. Taffy went around the world trying to get money, and he got Rockefeller Foundation interested in Carnegie Corporation. And with that money, he was able to say to the Australian government, will you match pound for pound, with help from other people, not Frederick White. And that became successful. He had £400,000, that's £800,000 of our present dollars, in 1955. And that was enough on the advice he had to start. But he was very edgy about it because the Federal Bank was in some trouble. Lovell was up before a parliamentary inquiry, the costs had escalated. And Taffy, totally different frame of mind. Lovell was a man who might get into those sort of troubles. Taffy wouldn't, in actual fact, and he wasn't going to get into that same trouble. It was pretty tough. And he asked me to go into it, and I remember Joe saying, you'll be getting into big structural mechanical problems one time or another. Just before that, he'd given me a problem of, you can see how his mind worked. The sort of Big Dish was going to become inevitable. And Mills had the idea of multiplying two antennas together and getting a very narrow beam out of this. And he said to me, now could you think of some way of getting three aerials multiplied together, using the Big Dish as one of them, getting the resolution of the Big Dish and the other two together, getting the collecting area of the Big Dish and the resolution of the others. It's something similar to, you needed a triple product or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I managed to find a way of doing this. Dick Mullaly, showed me an algebraic identity for a triple product programming. Some of the various products, and I was able to make this work on paper with the electronic circuits, and talked to Doug Lampard about the noise properties of it, and the signal noise all worked out. And it worked fine on this whole theory on discrete sources. I didn't look at diffuse standard sources until quite late in the day and found there was various cross products that gave spurious responses.
I see.
Oh, and it was a great blow to Joe. He thought, you know, we were under something really big. And
this is now what period are
you talking about? This was Yes, it was just after I finished the radio navigation work and I was going back into radio astronomy. That was tapering off the ionospheric work.
So what year?
So he gave me that problem and I worked this thing out. Early 55.
55.
I've still got those papers somewhere on that. That had sort of almost taken off, you see, and then it just crashed suddenly.
This was perhaps a way to combine the interferometry and the Big Dish.
His mind was probing around, well, if I must have a Big Dish, what else can I do with it? He's trying to combine, and then Taffy put it up to me about going wholeheartedly into the Big Dish program, going overseas, and Joe was saying, well, you know, you'll be leaving this interferometry stuff and going into the other. And of course, you know, in the event, Taffy's money went into the Big Dish, and Bernie Mills, he couldn't find money to support Bernie. Bernie had built his cross aerial out of Fleur's pilot experiment, but he wanted to build a big one. And Taffy couldn't support the two, and he lost Mills through that. So, you know, of course, that choice, if he'd had the money, he would have been able to keep Joe Causey happy, as well as follow this other path. But if it had to be one, then he had his way, and it was the Big Dish.
Yeah. Well, just a little bit ahead of ourselves, let's just discuss the results you got in your last couple papers on the 25 centimeter and 10 centimeter on the galactic plane, and you talk about this new quote-unquote discrete source at the galactic center, which is this figure right here, I think. Was this the first time that you recognized that something was beginning to show up at the galactic center?
Yeah, I think it was. As far as my memory now extends back to that time, I suppose I thought the galactic center was an interesting spot anyway. I don't quite remember the history of doing the experiment.
Those sort of maps would be made with drift scans?
Yes. Oh yes, just drift through and then plot the whole stuff up.
And you also...
It just said it was decided to conduct a limited survey in the region of the vicinity of the galactic center. I guess there might have been other work in the lab at that time that sort of pointed us in that direction.
You also narrowed in on the spectrum of the crab and Centaurus in that paper, and finding that the crab was basically flat.
Yeah.
And Centaurus not.
Yes.
Did you try to make anything of that in terms of what could be
explained? Oh, Jack would have. My memory's a bit dim there now, but he would have been thinking very hard about the difference in the spectrum.
That was more his department?
Yes, that's right.
Okay,
astrophysics, he sat down all day and thought about it and kept getting ideas.
I'll talk to him about
that. If you talk to him about it, I'm sure he'll find he'll fill out a lot of this for you.
But he he also contributed to the electronics, though, did he not?
Not too much. By the end of the war, he'd done enough applied work. He had a good brain for astrophysics. He used to clash with Joe a bit on the paper writing. I remember we had quite a lot of trouble because he'd get an idea and we'd work through it and get some results in the paper. It's something he had to get out pretty quickly because he had another idea when he was onto something else. And that didn't satisfy Joe, but he was often making claims that were just a bit beyond the data.
Mm-hmm.
And, in order to make it clear to myself what he was saying, I had to object to that.
Yeah, well, he was more of a speculative vein, too.
He was a speculative man, and Joe, I was sort of in between them, but sometimes Joe got me to rewrite some of that, what was more, deem a more sensible way, and he found I could do that. But Jack was had a tremendous number of ideas, and he couldn't wait to find out about them. He turned out papers very fast. He used to clash with John Bolton about different ideas.
In 1952, you have your last radio astronomy paper in this era, where you looked at Cygnus A and Cygnus X, as we call it now.
Yes, that's
And you postulate that Cygnus X is due to thermal emission.
Yes.
But you didn't call it Cygnus X for some reason. I thought that name was around beforehand, at least in the abstract. Cygnus X wasn't mentioned. It's 1952, is that the one?
Special paper on Cygnus. It's a diffuse source, one of the discrete source.
You call it a radio nebula, quote unquote.
It's got Cygnus X on there.
Okay, it does. Okay, we're just
and
in the abstract.
It's a diffuse. I don't know whether we added X on or whether someone else is all reading.
No, that was earlier. I forget who it was now. Yeah. Maybe Reber, actually, in 48.
Uh-huh.
And split it up.
Yeah, here's the two intensities there.
Okay.
Yeah.
But basically, it seems like the theme of all this was to take the, for then, high frequencies and do what you could with them, whether it be the sun, the moon, the galactic plane.
Anything you could find.
Anything you could detect.
Yeah.
And then you told me before, but if you could just repeat that, at this time you went off into radio navigation.
Yes, it was about the...
51 or
so? We didn't get a big dish, you see, and the Jack wanted. And I think after a while in this sort of thing, you'd start to reach some limits of the equipment, and that was an attempt to break out. You needed more flux gathering, and then we could have gone back on all sorts of frequencies from 25 centimeters down, no one else was working it. And we could have expanded the whole subject, but we got sources we couldn't before, and Jack very much wanted to do that well. And I would have had to do a lot of work on it, but it couldn't be done, and Joe didn't know.
That's just about the time the NRL 50 foot came into operation, in 52 or 3.
Yes. So making it as big as we could in that direction, that was a high precision one again. They were trying to get to still higher frequencies, but we weren't able to get this, and this would have been limited. Jack would have been frustrated by his astrophysical ideas, and I couldn't implement it any further. He's a bit upset when I did go, but that'd be a change. And I'd had another offer of a job outside. Taffy came back with me. He wanted some things cleaned up in navigation, but he'd lost Bergen. So I said, okay, I'll go into that for a while. And we went on until the money for the big telescope came along.
So that was
linked onto our ideas of Finnington, a much, much bigger one. But there was this gap of some years which I filled in with radio navigation.
Was 4 years then?
Yeah, 51 to...
55. That's the end of part one of the interview with Minute on 2 March 78, and obviously the battery pack was running down, and so the voices are getting more and more Donald Duckish and Mickey Mouse's, and we'll just have to repeat the last part of it, talking about the development of the park's dish and so forth.